From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle. This hour, a broad-ranging conversation about the L.A. Unified School District. No school system in California is responsible for educating more children. A tax increase to support that system recently failed at the ballot box, leaving many question marks over the district's finances and future. This hour, we ask LAUSD stakeholders, why did this tax increase fail? Air Talk, right after the news. This is 89.3 KPCC Pasadena, 89.1 KUOR Redlands, 90.3 KBLA Coachella, and 89.5 KJAI Ojai. Good morning, everyone. This is Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle. Coming up next hour at 11 a.m., a conversation about immigrant entrepreneurship. California immigrants are actually more likely to become entrepreneurs than people who were born here. If you're new to this country, you opened a business, we want to hear from you. We'll take your calls next hour, and you can weigh in right now on the Air Talk page at kpcc.org. But first, a broad-ranging conversation about the Los Angeles Unified School District. The nation's second-largest school district is at a crossroads. We all remember January when LA Unified teachers went on strike and they roused widespread public support. The deal that ended the strike seemed to raise hopes of a new day in LAUSD. 2 weeks ago, a proposed tax increase to help fund it all, Measure EE, went down to defeat in a special election. On the day after the vote, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti took the podium at a press conference, and let me read you some of what he said. "I'm worried about our children," he said. "When fall comes, class size will come down by a student or two. But in a year or two, that progress stops. None of us can pat ourselves on the back when there's only 36 students in a math class and not 38, closed quote. The stakes are high here. Almost 600,000 kids attend public schools in L.A., a projected 470,000 in LAUSD-run schools, another 120,000 in charter schools. Most of those kids qualify as low-income. Almost a quarter are still learning English. And I've also heard from a lot of teachers that the defeat from Measure EE was a real emotional gut punch for them. It makes them question where things go from here. So that's the question we want to raise this hour, broad-ranging conversation about the district in light of Measure EE's failure. And to start that conversation, I want to put the question to you, AirTalk listeners. Why do you think that Measure EE did not pass? Give us a call, 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. And not only why did it not pass, how do you think LAUSD should move forward from the defeat of that tax measure? Especially would love to hear if you're a parent in LAUSD, if you're a teacher in LAUSD, if you're a student in the system, you're out on summer break and you might be happening to catch us, I want to hear from you. And I hope that we can keep this conversation future-centric, but also keep in mind that there are some challenges raised by the failure of Measure EE. Joining us to discuss it all is Jackie Goldberg, an LAUSD school board member. She represents District 5, which represents parts of Northeast and Southeast LA. Ms. Goldberg, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be with you.
Also joining us is Alberto Ratana, the president and CEO of Community Coalition, a nonprofit organization that helps transform the social and economic conditions in South LA. Alberto, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kyle. Appreciate it.
And on the line with us as well is Katie Browdy, the co-founder and CEO of Speak Up, an organization founded by LAUSD parents who would like to change the dynamics of education policy and improve public education in California. Ms. Browdy, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you, Kyle. I'm glad to be here.
And again, I want to throw the question out to AirTalk listeners, to parents, students, teachers in LAUSD. Where do you think that LAUSD should go from here, especially in light of the fact that Measure EE did not pass and at the polls? And where? How should LAUSD change in the future, perhaps? And I think we should start with that question and throw it out here to this panel that we have with us already. Why do you think Measure EE failed? I'll put that question to each of you, but let's start with Jackie Goldberg.
Well, I think EE failed for a number of reasons. First of all, it was clear that in many places we had a too many special elections, and so voter turnout, which needs to be higher than average in a special election to pass a two-thirds vote, probably wouldn't get enough people even to go to the polls. The second problem was is that there was all of this wrangling. What did it mean? Did it include your garage? Did it include the property? So people became confused. But probably the biggest reason it failed, besides the fact that people have a hard time voting to tax themselves, and that's always been true, is that we had a lot of lies sent out. I'm a senior citizen. I received three pieces from Jarvis and from the L.A. Chamber telling me that I would be hurt by Proposition EE when, in fact, I would be exempt from Measure EE. So there were a lot of lies. People were told that it would cost them thousands of dollars, whereas the average was probably about, I would say, $100 a month. That would be $1,200. I'm talking about $25 a month. So in fact of the matter, I think there were a lot of problems with doing a special election in a short period of time in that particular time frame. But also there's been the underlying current, always, by the right wing, that somehow or another, LA Unified is a massively mismanaged district, and to give it money was a bad idea under any circumstances. Which, of course, is what you say when you do not wish to have any taxes on the wealth of this state, and that's a big problem. We have to tax the wealth of this state.
Interesting. So there was some confusion. There was what you, Ms. Goldberg, would call misinformation, as well as the idea that people mistrust that the money would be managed fairly, which you don't feel is a fair thing to accuse the district of. Let me put the same question to Alberto Ritana of Community Coalition. Why do you think Measure EE failed?
Well, I think overall it was an election that most people didn't even know was taking place. So not only is the low voter turnout a reflection of that, but just the general lack of awareness that this was taking place. In fact, one of the more meaningful elections that took place was in Council District 12, which tends to be LA's most conservative.
The only district that, up until recently, the only district that had been represented by a Republican.
Exactly. But the voters there still represent our region's most conservative votes. It's also the area that turned out the most votes for this election. And so I think overall people's lack of awareness around the election was a very big reason. And I would agree with the school board member that there is a lot of underlying myths about what's real and what's not with LAUSD that has been in the pipeline for the last 40 years. So I think that there's a larger narrative here that we need to upend, which is that, you know, since the 70s, we have not been putting our resources in, and now California, it ranks 41st in the country when it comes to spending for our kids, and we're surprised that we haven't achieved the levels of academic success that we want to see.
Katie Browdy, CEO and co-founder of Speak Up, why do you think that Measure EE failed?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things that haven't been mentioned yet that are important. First of all, I think that we have to acknowledge what was really said here. This wasn't an election where the measure went down because of some draconian requirement of a two-thirds majority to pass a tax measure. We couldn't even get close to a simple majority to pass this. So, and I think the other thing we need to acknowledge is that it wasn't just the wealthy voters that rejected it. It was also roundly rejected in some of the neighborhoods with low-income renters in the Latino districts who are frankly tired of being living in the districts where their schools are just not serving their kids. So I think the district does have to take some responsibility for this. I think we also have to acknowledge that this is a system that has not been serving all of our children well, and voters want to know that money is going to be used well. They want some transparency about how it's going to be spent. They want to know that that they will get some results from putting some money into a district that they believe is not working well for their kids. So I think we're talking about something that needs massive infusions of cash to make a real difference. And we need to be thinking about how we message that to voters so that when we go to Sacramento, when we ask voters to pass a ballot initiative in 2020 statewide, that they feel they're going to see some results from the money that goes into the public school system.
I want to hear your thoughts, AirTalk listeners, as well. Give us a call, 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. We want to have a broad-ranging conversation about where LAUSD goes from here. But all three of our panelists here have mentioned this idea of, whether it's a myth or whether you believe it's a fact that the district has mismanaged. Its money is not a good steward of the dollars that would have been generated by this tax measure. If you disagree with that notion, where do you think that myth comes from? If you agree to it, maybe you can tell us why. Give us a call at 866-893-5722. I want to take a listener call right now from Jennifer in Southgate. Jennifer, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say that as a parent and as a property owner, I believe that the measure failed because, number one, transparency with LAUSD has been horrible. Let's be honest. You go to a campus in LAUSD in South LA or Southgate, the things you see, you will not see in other areas of the city. And management at LAUSD has not been right. I went to school with employees of LAUSD who also attested to this, who also said that LAUSD was mismanaging money and that management at LAUSD was very heavy and they were not providing teachers with the resources they need. And more importantly, they were not providing the students with the resources that they need. My son goes to school, he goes to a charter school. Why? Because I feel that the school, the public school that is assigned to my area does not provide the correct education for my son to succeed in this country. And so we have to go and look outward to provide a adequate education for our children. And again, that transparency is missing from LAUSD. And also, I agree that a lot of us did not know about this measure, to vote for this measure. A lot of us didn't know. I was unaware of it until probably a day or two before we were supposed to vote for it. So in my opinion, I don't think it's a myth that LAUSD is not managing money correctly. I think it's a fact.
Well, so let me put that question to Jennifer in Southgate. Thank you so much for calling. Southgate is an area represented by LAUSD school board member Jackie Goldberg, and she's with us on the line. Jackie, I'm wondering if you can respond to that. I mean, what part of this does LAUSD need to own? Is there something that LAUSD needs to own about this idea that management of money has been not good in the past?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think transparency is an issue. I don't think mismanagement is. Transparency is an issue because I believe that the superintendent coming from the private sector is not yet used to doing things in public, and we're working on that with him, and I think he's responding. The budget that we passed last night is almost useless for anyone to know what's going on in the district, including policymakers, and I plan to make big changes in that. But that's not the same as mismanagement. The idea that there's mismanagement comes from this continuing notion that somehow or another LAUSD is spending more money than it is taking in. And yet, since 2010-11, the ending balances in the district have never been negative except for one year, and that was during the Great Recession, and that was 2012-13. And that year, there was a $5.7 million in the red. Other than that, since 2010-11, the district has been in the black at the end of every year. So there is no mismanagement of the money. Why does it look like there's mismanagement? Is because of a requirement that came in with Governor Pete Wilson. He said that school districts had to predict what they're going to get 2 years out based on a formula that the state government would give it, which is just a cost of living increase estimation, and not based on what the economy is actually doing or what tax revenues coming into the state are doing. And so what happens is that every time a district, including L.A., does a budget, they have to go 3 years out and predict what will happen, given assumptions that are not accurate, but are assumptions that are required by the state for us to use. And so that looks like every 3 year of a budget, 2 years later, we're going to be in the red. And yet that only happened once in the last 10 years, and that was a very small amount, and that was due to a great recession that we were in.
We're going to pick up with that thought when we come back after a quick break here on Air Talk. I want to put it out again to listeners that we're having a conversation about the future of LAUSD, particularly in the light of the failure of Measure EE, the proposed parcel tax, to generate revenues for the district. You can give us a call. Tell us where you think LAUSD should be going from here. What do you need to see from the district going forward? Perhaps academic programs that you think the district should be offering in order to make itself attractive and as attractive as possible. 866-893-KPCC is the number to call, or you can go to kpcc.org/airtalk and leave a comment. We might be able to read it on the air. Back after a one-minute break here on 89.3 KPCC. We're having a conversation about the future of the LA Unified School District. Where does the district go from here after the parcel tax to fund LAUSD went down to defeat in a special election 2 weeks ago? What kinds of programs should the district be offering? What kinds of changes should the district be making, if any, in order to move forward from that? Just before the break, we were talking with LAUSD school board member Jackie Goldberg about the perception in her view that there is mismanagement of money, that she sort of detailed ways in which she felt that it's provable that the money was not misspent. I'm curious to throw that to two of our other guests that we have here on the panel on Air Talk today. One is Alberto Ratana, the president and CEO of Community Coalition, which has advocated for the district to be spending more money directly to the schools that are serving the highest need populations. Beyond something as abstract as how big the deficit is or is not, and we can actually talk about that, put a pin in that conversation and pick it up later. But I'm wondering, Alberto, is there something that people on the ground who are sending their kids to schools in areas that you would argue did not in the past get as much money devoted to equity purposes, do you think that that might be part of what they feel is like, we don't feel like the district has been paying enough attention to the schools? Is that a factor here?
You know, look, I think yes. But I just want to take a step back to just remind our listeners that over the past 40 years, we've plunged in spending from number 7 in the country to 41st. We're spending $10,000 a year per student in California. And $10,000 a year is just not going to cut it in 2019. It's to the earlier point about mismanagement, look, LAUSD could do a much better job on how it allocates its funding. We sued the district because we felt that South Los Angeles and East Los Angeles was being shortchanged by some of the decisions they were making. Those are really important practical interventions that need to happen to move more money to schools and communities that should be first in line because they've been at the back of the line for so many years. That's what equity is about. So the district should absolutely do a better job of making sure that the money it has now should be far more aggressive in targeting those dollars to the communities that need it most. That's for certain. But that should not be a proxy for not spending more money. We have to, as a state and as a community, invest more in our children. That's why we're working on Schools and Communities First, which is a ballot measure that's going to be on the ballot next year to pump $11 billion back into our schools and communities that will help right size what has been essentially over $500 billion that has not been going to our schools for the last 40 years. That's a huge, huge problem. So we need more money, yes. Two, we need to target that money better so that the communities that our listener called in and talked about actually have the resources to provide the education that our kids deserve. And to the point that was made earlier on voting, look, I just want to be very clear that if, one, you're right, we did not get 66% of the vote, but actually in our communities in South and East, where voter turnout was lower, that's where we had the most support regionally for this measure. So it begs the question, what is it about parts of the Valley and parts of the high voter turnout that is rejecting supporting a school district that is 90% people of color. We have to have a real conversation about race and equity in the city and as a region, especially in a time where President Trump has put down the law around an epic battle. Are we going to say government is bad? Government is only good when we're going to invest in border patrol, militarization, and police, and government is bad when it comes to supporting social services, education, and programs that support our kids. Alan, we have an opportunity to draw a different line and say, look, this is a different region, a different community that's going to invest in our kids and invest in public, in the public good, and fight to make the public good serve our needs.
So two different conversations there about the idea that, you know, LAUSD, it's possible, could spend the money that it has more equitably, but the district also has to take a stand and step up and look for more funding. I want to ask Katie Browdy of Speak Up, the CEO and co-founder of that organization. Your organization in the past has been really critical of how the district has managed its money, but as Jackie Goldberg, the school board member who's on with us as well, made the point earlier, the district has actually been able to maintain reserves over the last few years. They've projected deficits a few years in the future. Those deficits haven't materialized. And I'm wondering if you're on board with the coalition to try and get more money to LAUSD, maybe the way to make that case is to make less light of these deficit projections, which have not to date come true, and maybe focus on the fact that the district has been managing its money enough so that it does avoid those deficits and has, at least in recent years.
Well, I think that really Alberto's point about the low level of spending overall is really the main point here. The district does always seem to find some money in pockets and holes, but I don't think that we can ignore the fact that the county has had fiscal experts brought in to require the school district to figure out how it's going to pay its bills over the next 3 years. The problem, I think, is that the voters, the public, the families in the school district want to see results. They want to know that the money that is being spent equitably so that the resources are going to the schools, as Alberto pointed out, where the kids need these resources the most. We need to have the most effective teachers teaching in the highest needs areas. And the only way we're really going to make those kinds of significant changes in the district is with a massive infusion of more money. We're totally behind the Schools and Communities First initiative. And we also think that Sacramento should be, the legislature should be addressing this. What if we were to make some really bold changes like that demonstrate how much the public respects and values the teaching profession? What if we were to be able to pay our teachers starting salary of $80,000-$85,000 a year instead of $53,000? What if we were to subsidize their education? What if we were to model that teacher preparation system on some of the most successful systems that turn out the most effective teachers, and then make sure that we're rewarding the teachers who are willing to teach in the toughest subjects in the toughest areas in the way that they deserve to be? That's going to take some real infusions, but it could also be accomplished in part by reallocating the resources that we have now. So we have to acknowledge that we have these huge liabilities, unfunded liabilities in healthcare benefits and in the pension system. And we also have to acknowledge that we are not putting enough money into this system to really make the kind of changes that have been detrimental to the same kids for decades.
I want to read a couple of listener comments that have written in on the AirTalk page as well as called in. Jeffrey on the page writes, I'm a homeowner whose children went through LAUSD schools, and I voted for Measure EE reluctantly. I consider myself a left progressive, but understand that many citizens feel overwhelmed by recent tax and bond and other measures that have failed to deliver on their promises. Ultimately, the solution to education funding cannot be at the local level. Emma in Los Feliz Avila's wrote in with a similar comment. We have a kid in middle school who live in a wealthy area. My husband and I didn't show up to vote for Measure EE because we don't think people should be taxed. We think companies should be taxed. The parcel tax was a lot of money for a lot of people. Daniel in Van Nuys writes, I wonder if it's possible to streamline information on the ballot. The wording is often confusing and people don't want to make the effort to figure out what it means. As soon as Measure EE said raising taxes, I stopped reading. I live in an apartment too. I'm a renter, so it didn't necessarily apply to me. Let me take a call quickly. It's Stephanie in Sherman Oaks. Stephanie, you're on Air Talk.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, what's your comment?
Well, I think if we put back Measure 37 in our budget, we would get the money that we need for the school district, and that's why people aren't voting for it, because the government is not doing what we are expecting.
Jackie Goldberg, LAUSD school board member, veteran of state politics and of the school board, can you talk about Measure 37?
I'm not sure what Measure 37 she's referring to.
Stephanie, which Measure 37 are we referring to here?
And they said that 55% of the lottery would go to prizes, 10% would go to expenses, and 34% would go to the school district.
Okay.
And Mayor...
70, thank you for the call. Now, we've done some reporting on this. A fellow reporter of mine has shown that a lot of the lottery revenue has gone up, but that the money for schools has not kept pace with the increase in lottery revenue. Is that what you're referring to?
Out of the school district. Out of the school district's budget. They took that much money out of the school district's budget.
Okay, got it. Thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate your call. Let's go to another call. We have Carlos in Malibu. Carlos, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, how you doing? I work for the district, and basically the waste that I see a lot of waste in transportation. I mean, talking about carrying five kids in a huge bus and five kids, one big bus. That's a lot of gas waste. Also, waste in food. Not yet.
Oh, Carlos, sounds like we're losing you. Thanks very much for calling in. Let's go to another call. It's Marcelina in Eagle Rock. Marcelina, go ahead. You're on Air Talk.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm an educator. My parents were educators in the district. My kids attend LA Unified Schools, and I myself am a graduate. So we've been in the system for a very long time. And one of the areas that I've seen that is a problem is that every few years we're state mandated to adopt a new textbook program for each subject area. So it comes out to every 2 years, we're having to be retrained. We're having to purchase new books, dispose of the other books or the other materials that we had before. And I feel that it's not necessary to adopt a new program every 8 years. And the publishing houses don't really change much. And I believe that that's a big waste if we could try to keep the resources that we have and not have to change our textbook program every 8 years. I think that we could save a lot of time and resources, because I spent a lot of time in training and it's kind of the same thing over and over.
Right. Marcelina, thank you so much for your call. Jackie Goldberg, I want to put that question to you, I think, because the reason is that the teachers union often would make light of the fact that the district might have been padding its budget. And just briefly, they always point to the books and supplies line. Is this a reason why? Is that a reason why the district has to budget for so much? They never end up spending as much in books and supplies as they budget.
I think books and supplies is a place where departments, let's just take example adult ed, or let's take elementary ed, those monies are set aside partly as a reserve against uncertainties in their area. So it is a little bit of a holding place. But part of the problem is that people don't realize that Proposition 13 not only destroyed the finances of the state by taking the wealthiest commercial property and taking it out of the ability to be used really for public good, whether it's housing or health care or schools, but in addition to which, it did two other things. It turned local school districts into agents of the state rather than having really local control any longer. So school districts, people think that school boards have a lot of power. Actually, they have very much less power than they did before Proposition 13. Before Proposition 13, they could decide whether or not we needed to have more money in our particular district and could put things on the ballot. Now, and also it added a two-thirds vote. So here's the problem that we have continuously, which is now the state decides that there will be a textbook fund and that you can only get new textbooks by using the adopted textbooks, using state money. Otherwise, you have to use general fund money.
Right.
What happens is that you have a push and a pull. You've got parents and you've got teachers and you've got people in the community saying, are you kidding me? This book is 8 years old. Why aren't you getting us the newest book? So we say, okay, well, okay, the state is going to pay for it. All right, we'll buy the new books.
I'm going to have to put you on hold there for just a second as we've got to take a quick break, Ms. Goldberg. I'm sorry about that. We will be back, though, to continue this conversation with our panel about the future of LAUSD. And when we come back, I want to continue a conversation and focus on how the district might change academically going forward. But first, we're going to take a quick news break with Julie Slater. Julie. We're having a broad-ranging conversation about the future of the Los Angeles Unified School District on Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle all this week. We heard during this conversation from David in Westwood, who says Proposition 13 needs to be repealed. People in California don't have the guts to do the right thing. It's selfish. They're taking away money from the future of kids. Until we repeal Prop 13, everything else is half measures. Serena in Silver Lake wrote in to say that she was bothered by some of our earlier conversations about mismanagement. I live right next to the LAUSD schools where my 10-year-old goes. There's thousands of dollars in books that's just sitting there. We have to raise $500,000 as parents to support the school's arts program, gym, and other expenses. With me to discuss the future of LAUSD is Jackie Goldberg, a member of the LAUSD School Board, Katie Browdy of Speak Up, and Alberto Ritana, the president and CEO of Community Coalition in South LA. I want to ask if anyone out there, Air Talk listeners, parents, students, teachers especially, where do you think LAUSD should make changes to the academic side of its operations? I want to talk about that for the next 20 minutes or so. Give us a call at 866-893-KPCC. What kinds of programs do you like that LAUSD offers that it should be offering more? What programs might not be working in your view? What are a successful instructional and academic strategy to move this district forward? Give us a call and let us know. 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Let's start just for a second because we have such a foothold on this issue because of the strike, and that's class sizes. It was such a big selling point during the strike. Alberto Ritana of the Community Coalition, I'm wondering if you can weigh in here. Do people, obviously people want class sizes that are smaller, but was that a stand-in for improved instructional services generally? Or should class sizes specifically be a focus for the district moving forward? Or is it just, did people just want generally better classroom instruction and that was the closest thing that people could understand from the public discussion of the strike?
I mean, I think we want both. We want smaller class sizes and better instruction. That's certainly what our youth and our parents tell us at Community Coalition all the time. And so I think it was a really important step forward. And you know, I really appreciate sort of a little bit of the pivot and a lot of the listeners' comments around Prop 13. I just have to agree that at the end of the day, the state does have to shift its priorities. And what's great about schools and communities first is that it will place the responsibility of paying for our kids on corporations and commercial properties, not residential homeowners, which I think was one of the biggest challenges with Measure EE. Folks are having a hard time in this economy, and folks are just thinking about, how am I going to pay for this? Why is this coming on my back? While I do believe we all have to pay into the system, at the end of the day, I think that the work at the state level around Prop 13 reform is really important. And the reason why I think it's important is that we have to also pivot away from this conversation of deficits and mismanagement and start talking about how it is that we're going to create inputs and surpluses of support for our kids, especially in communities that have a history of divestment. It's no surprise, and this is sort of to pivot back to your point, Kyle, but it's no surprise that Prop 13 passes as the state begins to go through a demographic change. So the majority now of our state are people of color. The majority of our schools in LA are now people of color, vast majority people of color. It is ironic to me in some ways that as the shifting population has become more brown, more black, more Asian, the resources have gone down. And we have, as a state, need to have an honest conversation about how progressive California is really going to be. What do our kids want? What do our parents want? At the end of the day, it's pretty simple. Our kids, a lot of the parents and kids that we talk to, they just want a shot, especially they want a shot to go to college. They really do. And I know that a lot of folks might get concerned about, are we preparing people all for college or not? At the end of the day, that's what our kids want. Our parents want our kids to have a shot at a middle-class career, a shot at college, a shot at improving resources in South Central. And the only way that a lot of times people see that is through a quality education. Now, there's more that needs to happen, but there's absolutely no way we can create the academic program for our kids without the investment.
Now, just because I made that hard pivot from finances to academics, Alberto, people might hear that comment and think, well, the issue really is, yeah, everybody wants better instruction, but you can't have better instruction without better funding. Is that a fair summary?
But the middle-class parents at these schools can afford, like myself, to provide my kid with the speech therapy that they might need, the extra services that might need. I might have the health care that our kid needs to access the kind of services. Well, a lot of low-income parents don't have that, so we have to really support that.
Katie Browdy of Speak Up, where does the district need to go from an instructional strategy perspective? Is it to continue this focus that's been baked into the next three-year contract on class sizes? Is it both and with something else? What is that something else? Where does the district go instructionally?
Well, I don't think that anybody would argue that class sizes of 39 are beneficial for instruction. It's kind of a given. Class size reduction is important, but it's not going to solve all the problems if the instruction in those classrooms is not highly effective. So I think one of the places the district can start is by looking at the places that we do have success. Where are kids getting an education in the communities where there are a lot of failing schools? What are these schools doing to prepare kids? Some of these, we see some real successes, for example, in the dual language program. Mm. We should be looking at those benefits are not just because the kids are learning two languages. There's a lot of research, for example, that shows how that affects their learning in all areas of instruction, and that it has some kind of a significant impact on their ability on their cognitive abilities and so on going forward throughout life. So things like that really should be replicated. Why aren't we doing more to replicate the programs that are actually working? And just naming something a dual language program, just keeping on that same theme, isn't necessarily the answer. Just as sticking the name magnet on a school isn't going to suddenly change the way things happen. It has to be a real intentional approach to changing the instructional method and the way families and students are treated in those schools, the way we empower our teachers inside those buildings. All these things need to be looked at in the context of where the successes are. I'd like to see the district start there first.
I want to hear your thoughts as well, AirTalk listeners, about how the district can move forward instructionally after the failure of Measure EE. Where does the district go from here? That's our topic for the hour. We've got about 10 minutes left to discuss it. We'll come back after a short break, but first give us your call at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5255. Or the AirTalk page, How Should LAUSD Change How It Handles Instruction? Back after a one-minute break. We're having a conversation about the future of the LA Unified School District here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Want to know where the district should be going from here? Frank in West Covina had wrote in to say that he's a maintenance worker in LAUSD and says the district needs more discipline in the classroom. I go in and I look at things and it's out of control. And I would have never given the teachers a raise until they could get their students under control. I want to take a call now from a listener in Carson. Rosie, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. So I just wanted to make a comment. I have five boys. We've done the private sector and the public sector. And I can tell you that one of the main differences is the parent involvement. Unfortunately, we can throw money at the system and expect them to do what it is, some of the portion of what the parents should be doing, but that's not going to work. I know that in the LAUSD system, they have meetings during the day. Well, I work now, so it makes it very difficult for me to meet those meetings that involve any kind of workshop or training. So they should move those down to an hour where parents can actually make these meetings.
Alberto Rotana of the Community Coalition, I'm curious to know how you think the district is doing on parent engagement.
I mean, I think the district has taken steps, but at the end of the day, in my opinion, I think the parent involvement and parent power ultimately resides in the parents themselves. We have to be willing to organize and get ourselves together and put pressure on the district. The pressures of the economy have made it very difficult. Parents are working two jobs. I mean, I'm a coach of my son's Little League, and it's hard to get kids out to practice just because parents are working two jobs. So, I mean, the district has got to think creatively about how to create space for parent input and parent voice and parent engagement to support our kids at the end of the day. So I think that that's an important point. It's something that I continue to strive for and to continue to think about our parents, not just as volunteers, but actually as voices for change, because they're ultimately going to advocate for kids in a way that is in their best interest. And I think that that's oftentimes missing. And again, you know, I just have to say that, no, it's not enough to throw money, but we're only spending $10,000 a year on our students. We're willing to spend $40,000 to incarcerate them. There's got to be something different in the way that we spend for our children, because, yes, we have to change the system. We have to make sure that they're getting the adequate support, the best teachers, the best support programs. But that can't happen without investing in them. And hopefully I'm thinking that in the next year and in the years to come, we not only change the anatomy of the school in terms of how instruction is done, but more importantly also we change our values and put money where our mouth is to support our kids.
Rosie, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Raquel in Maywood. Raquel, you're on Air Talk.
A missing point is a parent point. There's lots of negotiation going on between the district, among teachers. The teachers have their union. Principals have their associations in district as well. Where is the point of the parent? Parent, the negotiations go on and agreed upon, but where is the point of the parent? It's very sad that Measure EE didn't follow through, but we were well informed of whatever was out there. But yet, where is the negotiation? I would have loved to be on the table and set my point of view of how mismanagement money. I disagree, and they continue to open positions up in the district. But what happens to we get the crumbs down here? I'm an active parent. I have two students that assist in the city of Maywood. And it's luckily we're okay, but where is the rest of the, we're not all in the same page. So I think there's a disconnecting between the districts, the logo, and down to the bottom, which is the most important, our children are being disconnected from it.
Raquel, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. Jackie Goldberg, a quick question for you from Sable in Silver Lake, who teaches at a private Waldorf school, has always been a strong believer in Waldorf education, where there are no textbooks, where students can create their own textbooks. She says it saves costs, helps students learn in hands-on creative ways. Would LAUSD ever be able to implement any tactics like that?
Yes, actually, that's true. We are discussing right now with a Waldorf school about having it become a district-aligned charter for the first start, and then eventually to be able to use some of those things to make it possible through our magnet schools as well, or maybe even make it a possibility of schools to choose to do something like that
which don't have to be either a magnet school. We have a new category called schools of choice. A good example of that is the STEAM Academy. That's science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. That's what STEAM stands for. The STEAM team from Legacy High School down in Southgate just won an international first prize in Prague, Czechoslovakia, for their first place use of hydrogen cell fuel in running a car that they created that ran for 50 miles before it ran out of juice with the hydrogen cell that they created. We have a lot of wonderful things happening in the district. Our goal must be to expand them. I agree with the previous speakers in saying that where things are working, we should replicate them. Absolutely. We have expanded dramatically dual language programs. We are planning now to expand into pre-K dual language. We have more dual language programs than any other district per capita in the state right now. And it is a growing number of schools that wish to be involved with dual language. We need to put back music and art into the classrooms because, first of all, some of those things are the things that keep children engaged and excited about school. And secondly, we know there's a direct relationship between music, particularly instrumental music and choral music instruction, and learning mathematics. Because, after all, if you play any instrument, you know that there are eighth notes and sixteenth notes and dotted eighths. And what does that
mean? There's arithmetic there.
There you go. Not just arithmetic, but fractions, my God.
You know, we're running out of time in the conversation. I just want to interject a question for you, Ms. Goldberg, which is that, you know, there are places that want to start these themed programs, dual language programs, magnet programs. But a lot of times this comes down to board approval, board support, whether the school that wants to make this transformation can have the resources. And sometimes there isn't the board resources. There isn't the board support to make these things go through. Is there a role for the district to be more proactive in allowing these transitions to take place in communities that want to make these changes?
When I was on the board the first time in the 1980s, when we had massive overcrowding and multi-track year-round schools and all of that terrible, terrible time, one of the things that we did right then that I want to do again now that I'm back here is to push decision-making down to the local school level. We had something called LEARN, which was a private sector funding of training of parents, teachers, classified personnel, and the community to be jointly running their school, running their budget, their calendar, running their school. Unfortunately, after I left the board and after the superintendent who supported this, and we had LEARN in about 30% of our schools, it wasn't required. You had to volunteer. Your school had to agree it wanted to be trained. But once you got the training on how to work together, you could really develop any plan you wanted. I want to go back to that. We have a lot of talented people at schools. They shouldn't have to wait for downtown to decide whether they should change their instructional program. And so that's something I'm very, very pushing on, even though I've just got here again, is to be saying to people, if you've got all these people that have all these university training, you've got all these parents who know their children better than anybody else does, if you've got all these classified people who know how to make that campus work, then you need to put them all together and let them decide how best to meet the instructional needs of the students. However, I will go back to what both of your previous speakers have said, which is we don't have enough money. We don't have enough money. And you know how we know we don't have enough money? Because class sizes are so humongous. You know, we keep...
And that is a last word. That is a last word on this, that it does come back to funding. I'm sorry we're running out of time, and I just want to make sure I have enough time to thank all of the guests. Jackie Goldberg, LAUSD School Board Member for Board District 5, Katie Browdy of Speak Up, and Alberto Ritana, the President and CEO of Community Coalition. I want to thank all of you for coming in and indulging a very broad conversation about the future of the Los Angeles Unified School District. I really appreciate your time and the time of everyone who took the time to write and call in here to Air Talk. We have more coming up after a quick break. This is 89.3 KPCC Pasadena, Los Angeles, 89.1 KUOR Redlands, 90.3 KVLA Coachella, and 89.5 KJAI Ojai. Good morning. I'm Kyle Stokes. This is Air Talk on KPCC. So good to be with you. I'm in all week for Larry Mantle. It's been a fun ride. I appreciate you having me as part of your mid-mornings. Coming up later in the hour, we're going to have a conversation about immigrant entrepreneurship. If you are an immigrant, a new arrival to this country who started a business, maybe become self-employed, we want to hear from you. We want to hear about the risks and rewards of starting a new business in a new country. You can leave your comments right now on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org/airtalk, and we'll take your calls later in this hour. But first, vaccines. 4 years ago, California enacted a tougher child vaccination law. Religious or personal beliefs are no longer grounds for parents to excuse their kids from getting vaccinated. In most cases, the students can't even attend a public school if their vaccinations aren't up to date. It really is no shots, no school. Unless the child has a medical exemption, essentially a doctor's note. Now, vaccines are legitimately dangerous to the medically fragile, so there are rare cases where kids absolutely need these exemptions. Rare cases. But after several years of progress, California's child vaccination rates slipped last year, and state health officials are concerned that doctor's notes are, in some cases, allowing parents who simply don't want their kids vaccinated to ignore the state's new vaccine laws. State legislation meant to enact stricter oversight on medical exemptions has generated a lot of debate in Sacramento. Yesterday, the bill was amended. The question is whether the legislation went too far. The bill is now going up for a hearing tomorrow. And here to discuss these twists and turns with us is Melody Gutierrez, a Los Angeles Times reporter who's covering state politics from the Sacramento Bureau. Melody, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I keep calling them doctor's notes, medical exemptions, of course, the technical term. If we can take a step back and lay out some context here, what evidence is there that some doctors might be giving these medical exemptions for illegitimate reasons?
I think what's being cited is that there are some doctors that are giving out a large number of them. There are some ads that have been found online that show that doctors are actually soliciting for patients and advertising medical exemptions for a payment. So this is a money-making, venture for some doctors. And, I mean, I've been on some websites, Facebook private messages that I've seen in some groups there that have shown, parents actively talking about which doctors to go to in order to get a medical exemption. They talk about the payment, what's the average price that you will pay for it. So there is, quite a bit of evidence that there are some medical exemptions that are improperly being given out.
Now, another piece of context here, California, I mentioned, has this strict vaccination law, but it's a relatively new law. Why did it come into place,
Yes, I mean, it started in 2015 is the bill that got rid of the public, the personal belief exemption, which was often used for both religious and personal beliefs to exempt from vaccinations. That came about at the time that the Disneyland measles outbreak was occurring. It was a national conversation. So it was very similar to today in terms of a national outbreak kind of pushing a bill to make these restrictions tighter.
So that original bill got rid of the personal belief exemption, but that was 4 years ago now, 2015. Now the legislation that's moving through Sacramento is SB 276. I'm wondering if you can talk about this legislation's journey through the committee process. What was the legislation initially intended to do?
So this bill, it tightens that medical exemption. It makes it much more difficult for a parent or a doctor to receive one. It would allow a parent to go to their doctor, ask for a medical exemption for whatever medical reason, but that doctor typically would be signing off on that, and that would be the end of it. They'd be excused from vaccinations. This bill would essentially say that the doctor would then send that medical exemption to the state public health department, and the public health department would have the final say in whether that was a legitimate reason to skip some or all vaccinations. There have been a lot of changes to this bill as of yesterday. That review would not happen for all medical exemptions now. The review by the public health department would happen at schools that have a larger rate of unvaccinated children or for doctors that have more than five or more vaccination exemptions each year. So it would really target the schools where you're seeing a larger number of kids who are not being vaccinated and the doctors that are more often than not than others giving out these exemptions.
So initially, this bill was going to create a sort of administrative apparatus where every medical exemption written in California was going to be reviewed. I mean, was there a discussion about what kind of bureaucracy this might have created? Like how much it would have cost, what types of manpower and personnel and that sort of thing?
Yes. So the cost analysis for that was about $10 million each year. And it was something, you know, that bureaucracy was brought up by Governor Gavin Newsom as his main concern that the doctor-patient relationship would be impeded on by, you know, now creating a state overview where they could essentially reject a doctor's orders. There have been a lot of questions on who that state person would be that would be able to essentially, you know, override the doctor's decision. And in those amendments yesterday, they clarify that the person that would be reviewing the doctor's orders would essentially be another doctor. So that answered some criticism, but the amendments yesterday really did little to take away the opposition to this bill. That still remains.
Yeah. Can you maybe talk about that opposition and where they're coming from and how active they have been in terms of this legislation? Have they been, you know, packing committee hearings and making themselves vocal and known?
Oh, absolutely. This is a very large group, a very passionate, emotional group. The hearings for these bills tend to last hours. You're talking hundreds and hundreds of parents lining the Capitol corridors that wrap, I mean, these lines to log their opposition wrap around the building. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible to see the amount of people who come to testify primarily in opposition. The California Doctors Association, it's the California Medical Association, is in support of this bill. And so you do see a lot of doctors who are and public health officials that are there in support, but primarily the opposition is very strong. And mostly it's parents who have children who they say are vaccinated, were vaccinated partially and had adverse reactions. You have parents who, are adamant that they don't want to vaccinate their children and that this essentially would keep their children from attending both public or private school. It would force a homeschooling.
Yeah. Now, one of the first times that I came across this bill was Jessica Biel. So we might want to talk about her for a second. It seems to be sort of emblematic of the opposition here, at least to my outside perspective. And just to recap, how did Jessica Biel get her name involved with this legislation? What happened there?
Yeah, so last week she was in the Capitol lobbying against the bill. It's not been uncommon. In 2015, there were several celebrities that were in the Capitol as well for the first elimination of the public personal belief exemption. And it was really more common about a decade ago for celebrities to be very involved in the anti-vaccination debate. And so Jessica Biel showed up last week, was lobbying against the bill, very much tried to make that appearance quiet until the pictures of her with the anti-vaccination advocate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Those were posted online, and it really drew a very swift...
It was picked up in Jezebel. It was in the celebrity press.
Yeah, absolutely. And she sort of walked back a little bit her opposition. I think you typically see people say that they aren't anti-vaccination. What they are is pro-informed consent. And so she was trying to clarify her argument that she's, you know, not against vaccinations in general, but that she believes that a parent should be able to make that decision.
Yeah, certainly the optics of that sending a bit of a mixed message. But let's broaden from Jessica Biel, Melody Gutierrez, LA Times reporter covering this story. It does seem sort of emblematic of the opposition to this. I mean, there's a certain element that probably is anti-vaccination, and there probably is a certain element that has legitimate concerns about creating a second bureaucracy of doctors watching other doctors. Can you sort of give me a sense of what your sense is anyway of what the opposition to this bill, how it breaks down? Like for what number of people would rather there be a personal belief exemption and they just be taking that?
Right. I think that there are so many subgroups in the opposition. There are people who are adamant that vaccinations are toxic and should not be given at all. There are parents who are against certain aspects of vaccinations, that they don't want to vaccinate against certain certain vaccinations. They don't want to use certain vaccinations. They want some availability to be able to exempt their children from certain ones. And then you have parents, other groups that are just, their children are fully vaccinated, but they do have concerns that a parent's right to make this medical decision alongside with their doctor is now becoming a state decision. And there are some groups that are, in the medical community, lawyers and others that have kind of made that argument as well, that they see issues in this. There are a lot of people who are concerned about whether or not the medical exemption guidelines on what would qualify for that are going to become too narrow, that those who would now qualify for a medical exemption, a legitimate one, that, under today's law would no longer qualify for one under the revised SB 276.
So I'm sorry to jump in there, Melody. We are talking about Senate Bill 276. It has been amended. It's a bill that deals with medical exemptions from the state's relatively strict vaccination law. Initially, it would have made every medical exemption subject to review. It's been amended to soften that requirement somewhat. Melody Gutierrez of the LA Times, can you give me your assessment? Do you think now that this bill has, my understanding, won Governor Newsom's support and, sort of appeal? Or at least spoken to, not appeased is probably the wrong word, but spoken to some of the concerns of the opposition. Do you think this bill is going to pass?
I think that, the Assembly Health Committee will be a real litmus test for the rest of this committee process. It has both the Assembly Health Committee on Thursday, which it's looking pretty strong there. And I think that, lawmakers will have some cover knowing that Governor Newsom supports this bill. It's already cleared the Senate. After the Assembly Health Committee, it would go to a Fiscal Committee and Appropriations in the Assembly floor, and then it heads back to the Senate for a vote on those amendments. And so this is still a long, we've got several months left before this process sort of wraps up, and really anything could happen in there. There are still a lot of, concerns with this bill. The amendments did very little to address any of the opposition. But I don't know that that's going to impede the progress as this moves forward. It just simply makes it a difficult vote.
Melody Gutierrez is a reporter for the LA Times covering state government and politics in Sacramento. Thank you so much for being with us. She joined us to discuss Senate Bill 276, a bill that would change California's vaccination requirements to differently handle how the state currently handles medical exemptions from these very strict vaccine requirements. Back after a short break here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Glad to have you with us on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes, and all this week for Larry Mantle. Los Angeles city leaders want to put more teams on the streets to handle the cleanups of homeless encampments. It's part of a package of changes that went before an LA City Council committee yesterday. The idea is to provide more weekly, if not daily, services to the encampments. And in addition to putting more crews in each council district, the city proposes setting up bathrooms and trash bins for people living on the streets. Activists have long called for changes to how LA handles the sweep. So the question is whether these changes are a step in the right direction. And to talk through those changes, KPCC housing reporter Matt Tinoco joins us here in the studio. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Kyle.
So why is it that homeless encampment cleanups, we just hear all the time about them, they've been so controversial? Why is that?
You hear about the controversy a lot. It's because, homelessness is it's impossible to not see, right? The issue of having so many people living outside in our public right-of-way. Everybody agrees that this is a sanitation disaster. What people disagree on is what to do about it. For now, what we have is the city of LA has a number of different sort of sanitation cleanup programs aimed at sort of, depending on the program, they have different aims. But the goal is to try and sort of clean up the encampments. The problem is that depending on who you ask, the encampment cleanups are good or bad. Basically, the people in the encampments, as well as a whole coalition of service providers, are saying that the way the encampment cleanups happen right now, it doesn't really amount to cleaning up, and it's more of a way to try and get people to move to somewhere else. On the flip side is you have the situation that there is a huge amount of garbage, as well as just people living out in the public right-of-way with no sanitation services. You know, there aren't bathrooms on the street, so where do people go to the bathroom? All of these sort of issues that are coming up because we have such a high unsheltered homeless population in the city of Los Angeles.
So there's this sort of breakdown between people who just, you know, see this as they're just trying to get these people out of there. And then there's this other very tangled question of, like, should we be serving people while they're on the streets? Does that sort of create concerns about a permanent condition?
Yeah, I mean, that's the core, the tension. Okay, so the reality is that we have so many people living on the street, and try as we are to try and put them into shelter, put them into permanent housing, it's not happening anywhere near as quickly as anybody would like it. So because you have so many people on the street, the powers, basically the county health department has instructed local cities to get their act together and be like, okay, well, you can't shelter these people, you can't put them into permanent housing, but now, okay, so if the encampments are going to be there, you have to figure out how to provide services to the encampments. And that's what's touchy, is because there are a lot of folks who do not want the encampments to be there. So that's sort of where we are right now, is that you servicing the encampments, providing the sort of news item right now is that the city of Los Angeles is considering how to restructure how it does this. In the past, we have this sort of apparatus that was kind of, it's haphazardly assembled. It wasn't really thought out, and it's just sort of occurred over the past years as individual parts of the cities have said, hey, we need to have more cleanup services here, we need to do this here. But there, and it's evolved. And
so people call their council member, they call the sanitation district or something like, I mean, who do they call?
Yes. A lot of the system we have right now has actually been structured around 311 complaints.
Mm.
That itself is controversial. We have some of the advocates saying that we should not have a system that does encampment cleanups based on 311 encampments, because that it sort of nurtures tension between people in their own. Like, a lot of the people who are on the streets are often they're on the street in the same area where they once lived. People stay where they became homeless because that's where it's most comfortable. But then if you have a complaint driven system, then it sort of fosters a tension between those. And that's just one of little things. But basically, the system we have right now has evolved. It's haphazard. Nobody is happy with it. People on the street and are saying, OK, well, this is a violation of our civil rights. People in properties who want the encampments cleaned up are saying, OK, well, you do the sanitation things, but then they go back there. And also you've left a whole bunch of other trash there, too. And really what the city is trying to do right now, specifically it's the sanitation department, is trying to figure out how to do this whole thing better. How do we conduct encampment? How do we provide services to encampments without violating civil rights? How do we deal with the very real trash problem? How do we deal with all of these problems? Because the reality is that we don't have anywhere for these people to go.
So what would change after this committee hearing took place on Tuesday? There's a proposal that's now moving through the process of council committees. What is that proposal, and what would change specifically?
It's basically the sanitation department has come up with a very sort of sprawling plan that says, okay, we are going to we're going to consolidate all the variety of different sort of cleanup services that we have right now, and we're going to put them in under this one sort of administrative umbrella. They would be called CARE and CARE Plus teams, the cleaning and rapid engagement teams, which would basically be you'll have one team, one CARE team assigned. CARE team has four people on it, sort of devoted to encampment cleanups and outreach and service providing. In each council district, as well as some for citywide, as well as a number of other so-called CARE Plus teams, which have eight employees doing work in sort of higher impact areas. The idea is to lead with public health. The goal would eventually, it's being worked out. That's what you said. It's going through the council committee process. The first committee hearing was yesterday. There will be several more. It would require hiring a number of new employees. All of this is very costly, but it's also like, what else can be done right now?
Yeah, at a cost of a couple $1 million. I'm curious to know, too, has it been worked out whether LAPD will be involved with these new sweeps? That's been one of the most controversial elements of the sweeps in the past.
That police involvement in encampment cleanups is the chief sticking point. So advocates look at what has been proposed and say, this is all fine and dandy, so long as it does not come with a sort of criminalization aspect. Officially, we don't know. Officially, it is being worked out. I honestly could not tell you whether or not police will be involved in this new program that sort of is coming out. I think they're supposed to roll it out in October. Do you think that
this is a step in the right direction? I guess the broader question for you as a reporter covering this is in about a minute that we have left. Can you tell me, like, is this being viewed as a step in the right direction by some of the people who've criticized how homeless encampment camps have been done in the past? Encampment cleanups, I mean.
I think the recognition from the city, the acknowledgement from the city that this problem cannot be moved somewhere else is key. Whether or not that gets fully operationalized in the coming months, I could not tell you. But it is the city of Los Angeles acknowledging that, okay, we have people on the street. They're going to be there. How do we sort of relieve their immediate material needs right now? We will see how that proceeds. But what I read here is an acknowledgement, okay, it's that we're going to do street-oriented services, which may be unpopular, but it's also what other options are there right now.
KPCC's Matt Tinoco, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kyle.
We've been talking with KPCC's Matt Tinoco. The LA City Council is considering possible changes to how they handle the cleanups of homeless encampments. Here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about immigrant entrepreneurship. Back after a quick recess here on 89.3 KPCC. Immigrants take big risks coming to California, and once they're here, many take another risk, starting a business. California immigrants are actually more likely to become entrepreneurs than people born here. And a story by KPCC's David Wagner for our California Dream collaboration got us talking because it has so many eye-popping statistics in it about just how many immigrant-owned businesses there are and how much they contribute to the state economy and to the local economy here in Los Angeles. So we want to talk to you about it. If you're an immigrant and you own a business, we want to hear from you. 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Call in and tell us about your hustle. What type of business did you start? What types of risks did you take in starting a business? How did you do it in a place like LA, where real estate is harder to come by for anyone, much less for immigrant populations? Everyone's struggling with that. How is it going for you? As you're calling in, I want to play the story by KPCC's David Wagner, who went to the heart of LA's Thai community to see how immigrant entrepreneurs shape our economy.
She says if she can save enough, she wants to open up more than one Sozap.
Thank you.
Ira Rin Srirada sets up her booth at the East Hollywood Farmers Market. She tapes up a sign with the name she chose to describe her food, Sozap.
It's like a zap. It's, I mean, delicious, so delicious.
Her dad helps out. He grinds fresh ingredients for a spicy and sweet papaya salad. She makes Thai food the way she learned from her mom and dad growing up in northeastern Thailand. LA has the largest Thai population outside of Thailand, so she's betting a lot of people here crave the real thing. And she has big plans for Sozap. She's going to move into a food hall opening up soon called the Thai Town Marketplace. She's happier working for herself. Since coming to LA, she's had a lot of different jobs. She's been an Uber driver, she's been a server in a restaurant. She says that wasn't what she wanted to do, but it's where she discovered a valuable skill. The restaurant didn't have desserts, so she started making mango sticky rice. It was a hit. She branched out and sold her food at a local Thai temple. Sozap is her first attempt at starting her own business. It's hard, tiring work, but she loves it and hopes the risk pays off. Back in Thailand, Srirada had a successful career in the makeup industry. Her plan was to be a makeup artist for film and TV, but she couldn't get her foot in the door. Harvard Business School professor Bill Kerr says that's a pretty common story for immigrants who become their own boss. He says a lack of good job opportunities can push immigrants into entrepreneurship.
And so in those settings, they may find starting their own company to be the most attractive option.
But it's not a fallback for everyone. Many come to California with a specific business plan in mind.
Especially if you are launching a scalable national and internationally focused business.
About half of California's Fortune 500 companies were started by immigrants or the children of immigrants.
They are really the engines for our local economy.
Linda Lopez heads the LA Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. She says it's not just big companies. Immigrants also own many of LA's small businesses.
Their businesses generate about $3.5 billion or 45.6% of all the self-employed income in the city.
Immigrant entrepreneurs are creating jobs and paying taxes across California. Immigrants create about 40% of all new businesses in California, making it one of the top states for immigrant entrepreneurship.
Want to help me open that?
Chancey Martorell with the Thai Community Development Center doesn't want those opportunities to disappear. That's why she's so excited to see the Thai Town Marketplace Food Hall finally under construction.
So SAP will have that stall. She has an ideal stall because it's going to be fronting the sidewalk.
The Thai Town Marketplace has been Martorell's passion project for years. Rents for commercial space have gone up. She sees low-income entrepreneurs struggling to get bank loans. She wants this food hall to give today's immigrants their shot at opening a small business.
Otherwise, you end up just seeing a community of chain stores that have no history in the community. And so that's what we're trying to prevent.
Back at the East Hollywood Farmers Market, Ira Rin Srirada sees a big future for SoZap. She says if she can save enough, she wants to open up more than one SoZap.
Thank you.
That was KPCC's David Wagner with his story looking at immigrant entrepreneurship in Los Angeles. And we want to hear from you as well. If you are an immigrant entrepreneur, we want to take your call. We want you to tell us about your hustle, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. What type of business did you start? What types of risks did you take in starting a business? How'd you do it in a place like LA where costs are so high? And how's it going? Like Ms. Srirada and David's story, did you get into the business that you wanted to be in, or did you change and adapt in a new country? Give us a call, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. We're going to come back and take your calls in a minute, but first, a live news update from Julie Slater. We're back on Air Talk talking about immigrant entrepreneurship. Did you know that California immigrants are actually much more likely to become entrepreneurs than people who are born here? This is a story that was done by our own David Wagner here at KPCC, and it's gotten us talking, and it's gotten us curious to know from you, the listeners, are you an immigrant, and did you start your own business? Tell us about it. Give us a call, 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page. What type of business did you start? Is it the same thing as you studied maybe in school, maybe that you did in the country where you're from? And also, if your parents started a business as well, and you have taken it over, your parents were immigrants, came to this country, started a business, and you have taken it on as the family business yourself. 866-893-5722 or kpcc.org/airtalk. And with me here in the studio is the reporter who reported the story you just heard a few minutes ago, KPCC's David Wagner. Hi, David.
Hi, Kyle.
So why did you decide to cover this story? What got you interested in the immigrant economy?
So the team of reporters that I'm on with this California Dream project, we're doing a bunch of stories right now about cultural communities, kind of, you know, the interesting cultures that make California such a distinct and unique place. And I mean, here in LA, as a business reporter, just looking at immigrant entrepreneurship made such sense for that. It's, LA is such a hotbed for people from all over the world trying their hand at starting a company. And spotlighting that just made sense for this.
You walked through some of the numbers in your story, but just if you can hammer them home here for us a little bit here and maybe talk about, put that again into context for us, just how big of a deal is immigrant entrepreneurship in terms of new business starting in LA?
Yeah, I mean, in LA, in California, it's really a hotbed of immigrant entrepreneurship. And that's because there are, you know, more immigrants here in California, here in LA, than in other parts of the country. country. So statewide, about a quarter of people in California are foreign born. In LA, it's even higher. It's about a third of the population. But then, you know, if you look at new business creation, they play an even bigger role than that. So about 42% of new businesses in California are founded by immigrants. Nationwide, it's only about 25%. So, you know, just right there, you see that California relies on immigrants for new business creation more than just about any other state. Like New York and New Jersey are up there, too. But California's economy really does stand out for just how big of a role immigrants are playing here.
I'm wondering if we can put some of these numbers in a national perspective. And for that, we turn to Dan Costin, who's a policy and advocacy assistant director for skills and workforce development at the National Immigration Forum, a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about how California ranks in the national context of immigrant entrepreneurship? Like, is California ahead of the game in terms of these numbers? Is it, and maybe you can speak to some of the reasons why. Is it, as David says, that there are simply more immigrants here, more people to be entrepreneurs?
Yeah, David is correct. California ranks probably near, if not at the top, in terms of percentage that are actually creating new businesses. It's about 42% in California, and nationwide, depending on the study, it's about 25 to 30% of new businesses in the U.S. are created by immigrants. So California certainly is leading. And I would agree with David that probably one of the primary driving factors is the large immigrant population in California. And we see similar higher rates in other parts of the country, like in New York or in New Jersey, where you have correspondingly higher rates of immigrants in those particular states.
All right. We've gotten so many calls already coming in from people who are sharing their hustles with us here. I want to share a few. Alfredo in Chino Hills says, I'm an immigrant from Mexico, and I opened a transportation and trucking business. Initially, I was in supply chain and logistics for a big company in California, and it was through this job that I got the inspiration to open a business in transportation. Hong is an immigrant from Vietnam, called in to say that Hong opened a banh mi in Huntington Park. I felt there was a genuine lack of banh mi in the LA area, and I wanted to bring that to the community. And on the line with us, we have Tobias in downtown LA. Tobias, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi. My start with Buzz app, an app in the liquor industry, was something I could have never done in Germany. The United States simply provides a way bigger market and a lot of more creative people than I have met in Europe.
More creative than Europe. So you're in the tech industry.
I am, yes.
It's sort of natural that LA, it's sort of the Silicon Beach aspect of that. Was that part of what attracted you to LA, or were you just coming to America looking to start this startup?
Well, I started in New York, and LA, the attraction is obvious. We have one of the best weathers in the United States.
There you go.
Plus an enormous market for almost any industry and opportunities with Silicon Beach and Silicon Valley up north.
Yeah. Tobias, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. David Wagner, KPCC reporter with me. What kinds of breakdown of different sectors are we talking about? Does immigrant entrepreneurship cover a lot of tech sector jobs? I think a lot of people think about, you know, the immigrant businesses that they see often, you know, restaurants and dry cleaners and donut shops and things like this. But there's also the tech sector. How does that break down?
Yeah, I mean, immigrant entrepreneurship is really happening at all kinds of different levels. It is a lot of small businesses. Here in LA, there was one study that found that about two-thirds of these kind of main street businesses, they called them, were immigrant-owned. That's things like dry cleaners, restaurants, nail salons, things like that. But, you know, also in LA, recently, you know, nearly half of the Fortune 500 companies here were either founded by immigrants or the children of immigrants. So, you know, people are coming here to start tech companies, media companies. They, you know, they may be pulled into California. They may have a great idea for a company overseas and think, you know, California is really the best place for me to launch this.
Chancey Martorell is a person that you spoke to, David, in your story, and she joins us on the line. Chancey is the executive director of the Thai Community Development Center in Los Angeles. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So we heard in the story that Thai Town Marketplace, the food hall that you're working on, has been your passion project for a decade of work on this. What kinds of challenges have you been having to work through as you've opened up, working to open up this food hall?
We're a nonprofit community-based organization, and in order to make such a project even possible or feasible, we have to get a lot of financing to actually build the project, and that includes a lot of public funding sources, and also we got New Markets Tax Credit. Almost now $5 million project, and we are going to be done with construction come this late summer. And once it's open, it will be a food hall that will house 12 food stalls operated by low-income entrepreneurs, some of whom are immigrants.
Yeah, that I think is interesting too, because you're a nonprofit that's dealing with, you know, big fancy concepts like New Markets Tax Credits, but you're also talking about, you know, people, I don't know, maybe you can tell me, that are maybe starting their business for the first time moving into an institutional space. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what kind of challenges do you see the people that you're trying to move into your food hall, what challenges do you see them working through?
Yes, they are faced with multiple challenges. First, we did publicize the recruitment and selection process back about several years ago, and we publicized this in all communities. And we started receiving applications of first-time entrepreneurs, and we did require, if they were to actually become entrepreneurs in our food hall, that they go through our 27 hours of entrepreneurship training classes, financial literacy classes, work with our business counselor to develop a business plan. And because they're food establishments, the best part of all was to actually taste their food.
Oh,
and
perks.
Make sure, you know, that it will be palatable and delicious enough, you know, for people to...
Oh, it's like Top Chef Thai Town Marketplace.
Yeah. And so for people to really come and dine there. And so so that was a process in and of itself. So once a lot of them graduated from our entrepreneurship training classes, then began working through all of their startup capital needs, because a lot of these entrepreneurs, being low income, didn't really have access to capital. So it was very important that we help them get some low interest loans from community development financial institutions, also other nonprofits, so that they could purchase their equipment that they will need to start up their business or microenterprise in the food stall. So that includes like the refrigerator, the stove, the ovens, and what have you. Capitalize the entire Thai Town Marketplace, and that was almost $5 million worth of capitalization with all our financing and funding sources and all that. And we provide, for example, all the fixed equipment like the hoods and the storage spaces and the shelves and the counters and the three compartment sinks, the two compartment sinks.
So it sounds like you're taking on some of the capital risks,
right,
of some of this.
We are taking on a lot more of the risk, and they just simply have to pay their rent, which is 30% less than market rate.
Mm, interesting.
Own unfixed equipment, but we still need to provide them ongoing business counseling and technical assistance, because it is an incubator, the Thai Town Marketplace, and they'll have a shot at running and operating their businesses for about 3 years.
Hold on. I have to break you there for just a quick second, Chancey, because we got to take a break. But I want to pick up on this thought when we come back after a very quick break. We're talking about immigrant entrepreneurship on Air Talk, and we'll take some calls after a quick break. Thank you. talking about immigrant entrepreneurship here on Air Talk, that in California, immigrants are much more likely to start businesses than people who were born here in the United States. We're going to take some calls here in a moment. But just before the break, we were talking with Chancy Martorell, the executive director of the Thai Community Development Center in Los Angeles, who's starting up a food hall called Thai Town Marketplace, about the difficulties of securing all of the financing for this, especially for some new immigrant entrepreneurs who are starting up businesses for the first time, trying to train these folks to be ready to go out into business and be part of this community food hall. We have with us, for some national perspective on this as well, Dan Costin, who's the Policy and Advocacy Assistant Director for Skills and Marketplace, or excuse me, Workforce Development at the National Immigration Forum. Dan, I just want to ask you, when you hear Ms. Martorell talk about all of these difficulties that immigrants go through in starting businesses, is it? I'm also struck by the balance here, which is that sometimes immigrants have no choice but to start businesses. Can you talk about, you know, there's hardships in entrepreneurship, but are those hardships in entrepreneurship making up for even greater hardships in other areas?
Yeah, I think one of the things that many people don't understand about immigrants coming to the U.S. is one of the biggest challenges they face is the whole issue of licensing and credentialing. Like, perhaps the best example of that is doctors who are driving taxi cabs simply because they aren't able to get back into a profession where they both have the education and the passion and the background, but they simply aren't able then to return to those particular professions. And we see that not just in the healthcare area, but in many others. And I think that's perhaps one of the other driving factors for immigrants to consider starting their own businesses. They simply can't get into the work that they've been doing before, nor can they get to perhaps a compensation level that they may have experienced before, and therefore they consider things like opening their own businesses as an alternative.
Interesting. Let's go to a couple of callers who've called in to tell us about the immigrant entrepreneurship hustle. Mona is in downtown Los Angeles and called in. Hi, Mona. You're on Air Talk.
Hey, so my father and my mother are both immigrants from Morocco, and my father started two businesses because as a small pilot, he couldn't get into one of the bigger bigger airlines because of his accent. So I grew up with him in working really hard in two failing businesses, and as a millennial, it's really highly educated, but also can't find a job, I've been encouraged to become an entrepreneur, and I want to be as far away from that as possible because of my lived experiences.
Mm. Are you feel like the pull into to take over the family business or to go out onto business for your own?
No, to go out to business my own. There's nothing to take over. We are supported by my mom's job as a nurse, who went into that unwillingly, but she kind of had to because my dad's business ventures didn't go well.
Mm. Well, good luck to you, Mona. I wish you the best of luck in all of this, and I appreciate your call. Interesting also that you mentioned right after Dan talking about the big deal being credentialing, and here your father wasn't able to get into the business of the airline industry because of that sort of bridge there. Let me move on to quick another call. Andrea in Woodland Hills. Hi, you're on Air Talk.
Going. First of all, I want to say thanks for having this conversation. My parents are both immigrants from Mexico, and they started a contracting business over 15 years ago now. They do really well for themselves. My older brother and I are in the process of taking it over. I'm actually a recent graduate from UC Santa Barbara, and I did a year in entertainment marketing, and I decided that it wasn't for me. I always had that entrepreneurial bug. So I'm now working in the family business, and I'm really excited. And one other thing, one resource that we've always leaned on is the SBA.
The SBA. What about the SBA have you led on? The Small Business Authority or Administration, excuse me?
It's the Small Business Administration. I believe they have local chapters. We see one in Santa Clarita, and we rely on their counseling services. Any questions, we can go to them, and they're super helpful.
Andrea, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to Greer, who's been patiently waiting on the line from Glendale. Greer, you're on Air Talk.
Thanks for taking me, Kyle. My parents originally migrated from Armenia, and kind of growing up here, And I'm an engineer myself and just worked in the industry for about 8 years. And just seeing the market trends kind of got me into starting my own business. And we do basically engineering services, but more importantly, it's the automation side of it. All the jobs that are coming back to the States are more the high-end stuff, and that's basically the automation. And that's what, you know, especially in California, that's what's lacking is the amount of integrators available to handle mom-and-pop shops as well as kind of medium to high suppliers or customers.
Grayer, what did your parents do when they immigrated here?
My dad was an engineer when he immigrated. My mom did sewing for a while. And then when my dad came when they came to the States, my mom went to school. She became a nurse. And then my dad basically did jobs on and off. And now he basically drives a truck for a living and, you know, makes a good living for himself. Thanks. I think it's just the language barrier, that was the only thing that kind of stopped them from pursuing the engineering aspect of it.
Interesting. That's another point that we of course get to right at the very end of our conversation, but I appreciate you bringing up, Grayer, that so many of the immigrants that are starting businesses face that as a language barrier. I want to take one more comment here from Julie H. on the AirTalk page. Says, my mother is an immigrant who started her own business, a bookstore, which she ran for 40 years. She had a couple of employees in the 80s and 90s before bookshops started to decline. It's funny, until this segment, I never really thought about her being an immigrant entrepreneur. A very quick closing thought from Chancey Martorell, who is the executive director of the Thai Community Development Center in Los Angeles. If you have just 30 seconds to sort of give us an idea of whether or not you feel like immigrants starting their own businesses can actually be upwardly mobile in starting their own business.
Yes, because owning a small business is an often pursued pathway out of poverty, especially for low-income immigrants, and in particular the Asian and American Pacific Islander small business owners. They also play a vital role in local communities and making positive contributions to local economy, but unfortunately, while they're the most diverse in terms of ethnicity, language, and immigration history and education, they are completely looked at monolithically. There are so many subpopulations there. And so we, as a Thai Community Development Center, serving not just Thai, but all low-income folks within the API and outside API community.
Chancey Martorell is the executive director of the Thai Community Development Center in Los Angeles. The Thai Town Marketplace opens up in East Hollywood coming up soon this summer. Dan Costin is the policy and advocacy assistant director for skills and workforce development at the National Immigration Forum. KPCC's David Wagner also joined us. Thanks to all of our guests and to all of you who called in to talk about immigrant entrepreneurship on AirTalk. It's 12 o'clock.